Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 3rd of August, as we record. As is now par for the course, the Bank of England has just hiked rates again to 5.25% this time. We are progressing serenely onwards, though. We will begin the show with a look at a UK, or at least a UK-headquartered bank. That's HSBC, whose half-year results are out on Tuesday. Then our cover story this week is on companies with an AI edge, but not those big tech giants that have already captured a lot of the initial enthusiasm. We are also going to be talking about a part of the market that could do with a bit more enthusiasm. That's UK small caps, and ask if and when better times might finally be forthcoming. Joining me to discuss all this are, over the line, Mark Robinson.
Good morning, Dan.
Good afternoon, Mark. Julian Hoffman is also over the line. Hi, Julian.
Hello, Dan.
And in the studio, we have Gemma Slingo.
Hi, Dan.
And James Norrington.
Hello, everyone.
Julian, we will turn to you first because we're going to start with HSBC, and you have covered the interim figures for us. The company's had a good 2023, share price-wise at least. How did the figures themselves strike you?
Yes, it was a pretty good performance from HSBC, really. Basically, it's all built on the back of wider interest rate margins. So they had about 0.5% basis points of increased net interest margin, which fed through in a kind of leverage way to the income statement. And there was a surprise as well in that they elected to give back about 2 billion more of capital than they had forecast before the results. So the market was quite surprised by such a generous giveaway, as it were. Obviously, that's going back in the form of share buybacks. And generally speaking, the management seems to have put in the hard yards in trying to convince everyone that they're doing a decent job and the bank doesn't need to be broken up. We did see areas that they might be a little bit weak, but particularly things like Chinese property. But we'll probably get that onto that in more detail in a moment. But overall, it was a very solid set of results. And some analysts were saying that if you're a European bank investor, there's probably no better options at the moment than HSBC if you're interested in appreciating capital.
Yeah.
rather than waiting for some sort of black swan to come along and wipe out the year's gains.
Let's talk about China a bit more. Let's get the potential bad news, the potential shadow out of the way first, because there were some increased provisions in relation to China, Hong Kong assets, not least the ever worrisome property market over there.
Well, it is basically the commercial property market that's causing a lot of conniptions around debt delinquency and that debate, really. And in the second quarter alone, they had to book something like $900 million worth of charges against possible defaults. Interesting, about a third of that was from the UK corporate banking market. So it wasn't all China. But when you look at the state of the loan book, you can go into the results and they have quite a detailed breakdown of how they rate their own loans. So they go from excellent down to default. And when you look at the Chinese property market, something like 40% or more now are rated less than satisfactory. So it's becoming a real ongoing issue. And you would expect the market would be more nervous about it. But the thing that's keeping everything on an even keel is that the defaults are no higher than anyone has expected or how HSBC have guided so far. So it would probably take a major downturn for more of those loans to become delinquent. So that's why, in a sense, the market's forbearing HSBC's exposure to mainland China's commercial property market. But there's no doubt that it's in a massive bust. I don't think anyone's past the point of arguing that it'll somehow recover at this point.
And there have been other issues with China for HSBC, as you alluded to just before, specifically the question of whether the bank should be broken up, which is being driven by Ping An, its shareholder, the Chinese insurer, has been advocating for a rethink on that front.
Yes, that's right. I mean, The management, the chief executive, Noel Quinn, said that the matter was closed as far as he was concerned. But I think it's a bit like saying, no, you should send your mercenaries back to Belarus and it won't be a problem anymore. Definitely, they still have the structural problem in that two-thirds of their income is generated in a market that isn't the UK or Europe. And I can't see that Ping An will give up its campaign to see a restructuring of the bank, even though it hasn't had massively huge support from the rest of the shareholder board, which I think is quite significant, really, that a lot of people have been sitting on their hands over this. And, I mean, these results, plus the fact that they're giving back everything back in quarterly dividends, which was a key demand for a lot of investors, that they're actually returning capital in quite large amounts. The management seems to be trying to sway more of the base towards its position rather than Ping An. But, you know, I would say it's more like an armed truce than the end of the problem for HSBC.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're Ping An, their idea being to split the bank into eastern and western, you know, halves, if you will, that is going to retain a logic for them for as long as they're on the shareholder base. I think 20% of shareholders voted in favour of the plan in May, but, you know, that's still a pretty small minority. But it may be that, you know, if performance starts to degrade somewhat, that those kind of, you know, advocates will get louder and will become larger in number. So really,
yeah, at the high tide, really. I mean, you think they're at the high tide of the interest rate story at the moment. And if that changes substantially over the next 18 months, plus if they can't get their investment bank revenues recovering, then that might look attractive again as a way of boosting earnings for HSBC for certain numbers of shareholders. But at the moment, the management's position is very strong, so I wouldn't imagine that Ping An will be able to increase the amount of discontent based on the voting rights that have come through. But the other point as well is that wealth management is the future for them. So, you know, HSBC, as well as trying to be a universal global bank, is also quite a big financial services provider. So how that would get caught up in a split is another point of contention, really.
Is that, you know, notwithstanding the rate story, you know, could this be HSBC's time to shine because it is a global universal bank, you know, wealth management, investment banking, you know, retail banking in a number of different territories? You know, it's not going to be so reliant on the rate story and, you know, perhaps the end of the increase in net interest income margins that we've been seeing or been seeing some other banks heralding. Equally, you know, its investment bank is struggling, but that's only a small piece of the puzzle for HSBC. So really, in this kind of interregnum, if you will, perhaps that global banking model will look more attractive to investors.
Well, it certainly has its resilience, and the other thing that's quite interesting about them is that their implied cost of capital is one of the lowest. You know, so when you go kind of the risk premium that the market attaches to each of these banks, it's not really through the shares; it's through what they're charged to hold and raise capital. And HSBC is something like the bottom three in the world, whereas, you know, people like Deutsche Bank and Barclays are leading the pack in terms of having to pay quite a lot for the capital they use. And I think that tells you how investors view the model, in that it seems to be incredibly resilient to any number of types of shock. I mean, let's not forget that the bank came through the 08 crisis largely unscathed, and it seems to be managing the downturn in China within the limits it set itself. So, yeah, it has a kind of attraction as a continued global bank. And again, that comes back to the argument as whether it should stay that way. And if it were broken up into its separate halves, would that also reduce the investment case accordingly? So, I mean, there is a kind of story that at least the managing board can tell there.
Yeah. We have the company on hold at the moment, you know, share price perhaps up with events, up with most of these things we've spoken about. But Mark, you wanted to talk about the dividend as well as the buybacks.
Yes, yes. It's interesting, really, what Julian was mentioning before, because obviously the net interest margin, that's the key metric, or one of the key metrics where banks are concerned. It's been heading in the right direction, obviously, and while that's had unfortunate implications for users of the bank's products, it's rather better for shareholders and the London market as a whole. I looked at Computershare's dividend monitor covering the second quarter, and what stood out was the fact of the contribution from the banks. They've been booking very strong profits, and beyond the buybacks themselves, they paid £7.8 billion in the second quarter. That's an increase of three-fifths year on year. So it does show that there are some benefits for a higher from a higher interest rate environment. Interestingly, with the dividends as well, the headline growth was hit by a fall in special dividends. That was down by 86% year on year too. But then again, when you look at that, most of that, or at least half of that, was related to a return from Capricorn Oil after the rejection of the Tullow Oil merger. So once you take that out of the equation, underlying dividends have actually ticked up slightly over the period, which surprised many people too. And at the center of that is the banks. One other point as well in Julian's article, I did note that he says that the HSBC isn't subject to the same kinds of regulatory pressures at the moment compared to some of its peers. Mm. Presumably that relates to liquidity ratios and capitalization rather than any their dalliances in the past with Mexican cartels.
Well, I mean, you know, we all make mistakes, Mark.
Indeed.
I think that the point of that is that they're not under the political, because obviously, I think they're technically based in Hong Kong, but have the subsidiary in the UK. So it's not under the same political pressure as, say, NatWest, which is 40% owned by the government, effectively.
Yeah.
And the fact that the other banks can more or less be bullied by the FCA. So it's in a slightly different category, which is what we were referring to there.
Let's move swiftly on. HSBC has had a good year, as mentioned, stock market wise, but even that is nothing in comparison to anything really that has been associated with the idea of artificial intelligence and indeed the burgeoning reality of AI as well. Our cover story this week, though, looks at the subject from a slightly different angle, trying to find some companies with an AI edge, but those that nonetheless aren't the immediate ones you think of. They aren't, you know, certainly not Nvidia, the tech giants. James, you've written the piece. Can we start with maybe some of your thinking, if I haven't just summed it up already, but also maybe this idea that you know, the picks and shovels, as they're called, might not be this time the best way to play this new theme?
Well, that was very much the premise I started out with, Dan, but actually I'm not quite sure that's true. But I think there was a great deal of value looking at companies that are getting a bit ahead on the implementation of AI, and also looking at the speed with which, you know, they're making progress actually sort of feeds back into the picks and shovels companies of thinking, you know, well, how well can these companies do out of this, or is this a short-term bubble that is going to disappoint people and deflate very quickly when you know, we're not seeing massive earnings boosts? I mean, obviously, in the very sort of recent history, the tech companies have done pretty well with their US quarterlies recently, and I think their earnings beats for Microsoft, Alphabet and Meta Platforms, with three of the companies sort of at the vanguard of AI, if you like. But the purpose of my piece was really to look at some of the companies and industries that are applying AI and seeing, well, are there companies that, you know, aren't on sort of, you know, 30, 40, 50 times current year earnings valuations that could be a way to play this. And I think, you know, the conclusion really was that there are some encouraging signs, but that has to be tempered by some of the other general risks that these industries face. I mean, I look at a company like Siemens in Germany, which is one of the ones I looked at. You know, it's a very sort of strong business, you know, Europe's sort of a real sort of bastion of European industry. They have their own AI lab, you know, with about 500 patents and 250 experts employed. That's one element, but obviously at the moment, that's kind of secondary to the travails of the German economy.
Mm. I should also talk about the picks and shovels argument. For those who don't understand my phrasing there, it is more about, you know, the companies who are providing the, well, in this case, the server power and the data centers and things like that. And in NVIDIA's case, providing the GPUs to power this AI revolution. The idea being that sometimes it's best to get in on the ground floor rather than looking at companies that do implement these services. But as you say, you know, we are focusing on the latter in this piece. Siemens, one suggestion there. I suppose the question is really, how quickly should we expect these kind of benefits to filter through? How quickly could we start seeing some of these, you know, AI developments at companies such as Siemens coming through, starting to affect, if not necessarily the bottom or top line straight away, but affect, you know, the way they do things? Is it already happening?
Well, it's already happening in terms of, you know, implementing the technology. For example, the London Stock Exchange, which reported today, I mean, they've been using AI in terms of advanced dealing solutions for FX exchanges. That's one example. There's definitely been in healthcare, biotech and pharma, in clinical trials, the ability of AI to be used to make better sense of trial data, and even to create synthetic data as well to broaden the test database. That type of thing is already happening. When it will feed through to products and services that will, you know, genuinely make a huge difference to revenues, and also crucially savings, which will also, you know, drop through to the bottom line as well in operations. That's quite difficult. You know, we're looking at that. There are some hurdles to adoption, which is actually why it's also quite interesting to look at end user companies, because you know, people are worried about, you know, their IP going into the blob with AI if they partner with an AI firm, and you know, things just getting swallowed up and becoming part of the search semantics and not being their IP anymore, and not to mention issues around data security and data protection. So it's you know, these are sort of poorly understood at the moment, and that's potentially a barrier to adoption.
Yeah, I suppose that is the contrast with the, you know, the tech giants who very much are, you know, or certainly NVIDIA being ramped up very much on the prospect of future earnings, notwithstanding its current earnings are also pretty good. But, you know, it's a lot easier for those companies in some ways to, you know, make that leap, because that's all they kind of need, you know, those expectations. When you're talking about end users, you need to see the real evidence of it to make that story compelling, or compelling enough to offset some of the other, you know, threats and challenges for the business, as we spoke about. The other thing in the piece that I found particularly interesting was when you talk about, you know, company moats. And obviously, again, with the tech companies, AI is seen as very much something, a big tech thing. You know, they've got the computing power, they've got the money to spend on development. But you make the point that for a lot of other companies, you know, AI might have the effect of, you know, draining rather than raising these moats for companies. You know, it could be a threat as well as an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And also, I mean, if this technology is all it's cracked up to be, it's going to become ubiquitous, which basically means it's going to open, it's going to reduce certain barriers to entry. It's going to democratize certain operational efficiencies. And that's going to be something that will have an effect on the competitive landscape of a lot of businesses. And you know, also the downsides I've mentioned before. You know, if you're just because you've been an early adopter in AI, you may have you may be a canary down the mine, and you may sort of get some of these things wrong in terms of protecting your IP, in terms of data protection, customer data, etc. And the people who come after you may learn a bit more. I mean, I think that one of the key memories, I'm sure a lot of our listeners will remember the dot-com bubble. You know, the internet didn't disappear after the dot-com crash, but a lot of companies who went in early and did. So I think that's kind of why, I mean, I focused the piece on actually some companies, for the most part, that already have sort of very strong propositions in the markets in which they operate. Mm-hmm. And this is something that could augment that strong position, as opposed to being the bright new shiny thing that they're all depending on.
Yeah, that makes sense. We spoken about a couple of those companies. We won't talk about them all, as usual. We'll save that for, you know, those looking at the story, picking up the magazine. LSE, though, can we talk a bit more about how AI might help it in future complement.
I said, I mean, in the earnings announcement this morning, there was a line mentioning, they're pleased with their sort of AI developments, and they talked about it specifically. They mentioned it in the context of the FX dealing, but actually it's not so much on the traditional side of their business, the exchange side. It's actually, if you think about the data side, obviously the big acquisition of Refinitiv a couple of years ago, if there is a question mark about, aside from the genuine negative view of the UK as a place to list at the moment, which is a separate issue, but in terms of the business, it is how well they can make that Refinitiv acquisition work for them, because data is a huge, if you also chuck in the fact that they own FTSE indices as well, there are potentially some pretty exciting applications of AI. I mean, in terms of really packaging and making data products better and more intuitive, and maybe attacking the market position of somebody like Bloomberg in data terminals and mopping up more of that sort of next layer, but also in terms of index construction, index rebalancing, index creation. When you talk about sort of ETFs, an industry worth trillions, and index licensing, this is an exciting opportunity as well. But obviously, a lot of this is sort of conjecture, and as I think Julian, who covered the results for us this morning, it's very much still about the here and now.
On that note, Julian, what's your take on, well, the short term, the recent past for LSE? What were those figures like from your point of view today?
Yes, it was an interesting set of figures from LSE. Just to return to that AI point, they mention it once in the whole statement in relation to their risk profile. So it's obviously something they're developing in the background, I think, rather than pushing to the fore. But there's clearly opportunities for matching data to users. I mentioned that's a very good use of artificial intelligence. But the figures themselves were pretty much as the market had forecast. So they were affected by a 4x and some issues around the timing of subscriptions. So the pre-tax line was down about 19%, but people seem to regard that as largely a technical issue rather than denoting anything more fundamental. And as James is alluding to, I mean, they are spending a lot of money on development. So in the half alone, they spent about $390 million on maintenance capital expenditure. So that's just keeping the lights on and everything up to date. But the total spend was $488 million. So there's definitely an excess that's going into new business areas and developing how that Refinitiv merger is going to come through and deliver those data customers. So it was an interesting set of results, but not really out of the ordinary, really, for how people had expected them to turn out. So yeah, if that makes sense, they were kind of expected, and a lot of people took the opportunity to cash in a bit on the shares, which have performed actually quite well over the last 6 to 8 months. So there was a bit of profit taking there as well. So yeah, the key point with LSE is that they just generate vast amounts of cash, and any organization that can do that can afford then to deploy the latest technology in order to support the business.
I dare say it won't be too long before they are touting the benefits of AI, going all guns blazing. That does seem to be the way forward for company reports at the moment. Any mention of AI that can be made will be made.
It's very much what I found with writing the feature. I mean, and it is still, I think, that you are focusing still on the core fundamentals for companies at the moment. But where there is a potential application and companies are moving first, then it's a nice potential kicker. But obviously, the valuations are based on the core business models as they should be at the moment, because this is still something slightly ephemeral.
Well, as I say, that is our cover story this week. So if you are interested in AI, then do pick it up and take a look. For now, though, we are going to turn to our final segment of the show, which is on small caps, smaller companies, and UK smaller companies in particular. This is something, Gemma, you've written about this week. Our Bear Bull columnist has also written about it this week. We'll start with the research we're looking at from MSCI in particular. What does that say about small caps?
I think basically it's telling people to hang on in there, really, and that good things might be around the corner. So there seems, I mean, there's loads of research in this area, but MSCI published research last month, which basically said small caps have historically outperformed larger ones, especially after recessions and over longer time periods. And I think they're looking forward thinking, well, if there is going to be a recession, that means after that there could be a really, really strong rebound. And they had this useful graph which basically looked at US small caps in particular over 70 years and tracked every single recession and showed in every instance small caps did outperform to varying extents afterwards. But I think it's a matter of timing, which isn't always easy.
Yeah, as that implies, obviously, you know, the UK market, the start of this year, there were some quite big hopes for the small cap section, not least because it had underperformed so badly last year. Still been a little bit underwhelming this year. AIM, certainly the actual FTSE small cap, has been a bit better. It's interesting, though, in the US, that you know, for all our talk of AI and, you know, the S&P being powered by these seven companies, that the Russell 2000, I think it is, the smaller cap index, has done quite well as well. So it could be a sense that they are further along the economic journey, or, you know, it could be something else, perhaps.
I think so, yeah. And it does seem very much linked to the minutiae of the economic outlook at particular points. So I was looking at one investment trust that focuses on small companies, and the chairman there was basically saying that investors seem to have this obsessive interest in what's happening in the very near term with interest rates. And as you say, US, maybe the outlook's a bit more positive. And the UK is still feeling pretty gloomy. So that seems to be weighing on the stocks here, I think.
Yeah, we shouldn't forget, of course, you know, the specifics of each individual company, which is always going to be, you know, crucial to success. That said, some of those qualities may be being overlooked at the moment. Aberforth, I think it was, who you spoke to, obviously they have an interest in this area, but they seem to think, you know, that in the UK, small caps they're looking at least, you know, they still look operationally pretty good.
Yeah, the frustration was palpable, really, when I was looking at their half-year results. They were basically saying, from a balance sheet perspective, the companies are way stronger than they have been for a while. So they look back to the 2009 recession when they said, you know, lots of companies were overly leveraged and got into trouble because of that. Whereas today, they're going in, many of them had sort of cash positions, but if they didn't, they didn't have huge amounts of debt. And then jumping back to that MSCI research, they were looking at profitability in global small caps, and they were basically saying profitability was good, and analysts were starting to improve their EPS forecasts after, you know, quite a bad 2021 and early 2022. So it seemed, at least from the fundamentals, that things are okay, but investors just are still quite cautious.
Yeah, to detour slightly into the aforementioned Bear Bull column this week, I think Mr. Bear Bull, well, I know Mr. Bear Bull because I've read the column. He looks at some of the companies he highlighted in this area a year ago and kind of compares the status of them now, not just their share price performance, but also, you know, profit margins, return on assets. And in line with what you just said, Gemma, you know, most of these companies have managed to maintain or even increase margins, return on assets is much the same. You know, dividends increasing, dividend yields a little bit higher, dividend cover a bit lower, but not too bad. So there is the sense that these companies are still being overlooked a little bit. He goes into, you know, specifics of the individual companies there. But there is this sense that, you know, in some cases, they're just waiting for buyers to emerge, which leads me on to maybe the final point, which is that in some cases, these buyers, of course, are emerging from outside the stock market, or whether that be private equity or, you know, a US firm or something like that. You know, there has been bid activity for small caps, and arguably that is going to continue if these companies still perform well but their share prices are still languishing.
I think so. I mean, they are really, really cheap by the looks of things. And Aberforth pointed out that particularly the really small companies, so ones with market caps of under £600 million, seem to be at this massive discount. And they're kept an eye on what was going on with the private equity firms. And I think there have been six bids between January and June for companies on the new Miss Smaller Companies Index, all of which represented a big premium to their current share prices. So there is interest in the space, but I suppose it's just hard to know whether things will get worse before they eventually get better.
Well, to bring things full circle, obviously the Bank of England has raised rates again today. may be nearing the end of its hiking cycle, so perhaps we're getting closer to a point where people do start to look again at this part of the market and think about where those growth opportunities might come from. That does bring us to the end of today's show, though, so thank you very much to Gemma, to James, to Mark and to Julian, and thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.